Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to Exploring the Lord of the Rings. This is session number 295, and tonight we will look at Gandalf's attempts. I was about to say his spells, but we'll see about that. That's one of the questions. We'll look at Gandalf's attempts to open the doors of Moria and what exactly his problem-solving strategy is and what conclusions he seems to have drawn about the door and its riddle. By his actions. So that we're going to focus on that here tonight. But first, a quick announcement. And tonight's announcement is very different. You probably have heard this before, but I wanted to mention it and talk about it. The big news in the Tolkien world today is that Hammond and Scull have finally publicly announced a publication date for the complete poetic works of J.R.R. Tolkien. This is something I've been waiting for years and years. I've been wanting to see this happen. Somebody to collect together in one place all of Tolkien's poetic works. It's supposed to come out in September, and it's supposed to be over 1,500 pages long. 1,500 pages of there's going to be some commentary and explanation stuff. It's not going to be 1,500 pages of just poetry. But anyway, it's you're right, Dorit. It's not exactly complete. Believe it or not. And of course, that would be really tricky because, of course, the only thing people would accept as a complete poetic works would be like every single draft of every single poem that he ever did. But anyway, it's going to be really, really cool. Yeah, Barry Adair, that's exactly right. there was an online group I was discussing this on, and it was a bunch of people who work in a bunch of different media and everything. So like there were some TikTokers in there. They're like, oh yeah, it's so cool. We could do like, you know, one TikTok per poem or something like that. I'm like, one TikTok per poem? Are you kidding me? I'm like, it's like, you know, I don't even know, you know, like 6 to 12 hours per poem is what we're talking about. Yeah. So, anyway, exactly. The joke inside, we were talking about it at Signum, and James Tauber and Sarah Brown and a couple of us were kind of joking about it. And we were talking about, you know, how much fun it would be to do some space modules in our space program on the Poetic Works when it comes out. And I was like, yeah, so we're talking like one month module per poem, right? You know, that's going to be the plan. We'll see. Yeah, it is going to be multi-volumes, I believe. Yeah, exactly. It's a lot. It's going to be a lot. Am I going to talk about the poems? Oh, yeah, I'm going to talk about the poems. How are we going to do that? I have no idea yet. But we got a little bit of time. They're not coming out until September, so we'll see what we can do. I have a few notions. I have a few different notions. We'll see. But yeah, it's delightful. And so to answer another question, which is a very popular question, what poem am I most looking forward to seeing? Because, of course, there are some poems that we know that he wrote but haven't been published. What item in the collection am I most excited to see? And my answer is Monoceros. That Monoceros is the answer. So if you remember Sam's elephant poem, right, which is sort of inspired by but very, very loosely based on Yumbo, the original. So he wrote this collection of four poems. on animals, right? One was the original, was Yumbo, the original elephant poem, which, like, makes jokes about, like, drug and alcohol usage and stuff. It's really funny. And then, of course, another one was the original version of, Festotacoulon, which, of course, a heavily revised version of that, though not quite so heavily revised as the version of the elephant poem that Sam includes, that, you know, that Sam speaks in the Fellowship of the Ring, in the Two Towers. Anyway, so both of those two revised versions of the Festotacoulon poem and of the elephant poem make it into the corpus later on, but there are two others, right? And Monoceros is, we know the title, like, so Monoceros, the one-horned, which I think is a poem about a unicorn, perhaps, or something. I don't know, but I can't wait to read it. That's my number one. That is my, not say it's the only one that I'm interested in, but that's my number one that I'm interested in. Definitely Monoceros. Yes, especially because that whole set of poems, they're hilarious. I mean, and where you can read them, by the way, the originals, Yumbo, the poem about the elephant, and the original Festotacoulon poem is in Hammond and Skull's edition of The Adventures of Tom Bombadil, where they included all the originals that Tolkien was adapting from. But, what are they called? Freaks of Physiologists, I think, was the collection of the four poems originally. Anyway, yeah, I'm looking forward to both of the other two Freaks of Physiologists, but especially Monoceros, because did he actually write a poem about a unicorn? I don't know. So, it might be a rhinoceros, Everett. That's exactly, I will be, I mean, the other two that we know, you know, we've got whale and we've got, elephant, right? So it's not like it's otherwise a series of fantastical creatures, which is why Monoceros always intrigued me. So that is my answer for the poem I am most looking forward to. It could be a narwhal. It absolutely could be a narwhal. I'd be a little bit surprised on account if he did another whale one. Now, again, you might be saying Festotacoulon. You know, you might be thinking I'm trying to pull a fast one on you, because Festotacoulon, if you know The Adventures of Tom Bombadil, you're like, hey, wait, Festotacoulon is a turtle. It's not a whale. The original was a whale. We will see. we will see in September. So that's a very exciting piece of news. And in the meantime, I'll figure out what we're doing. I would have no desire to rush through that. We could, of course, do it in the context of the Mythgard Academy, but I wouldn't want to delay. We want to do the Peoples of Middle-earth, and also, presumably, people will want to talk about something else other than that three-volume set over the course of the next 10 years. It could be after the Peoples of Middle-earth, but then think how long we'd have to wait to talk about it. I mean, we'd be waiting a year from now, at least. Anyway, so we'll see. There are possibilities. There are other possibilities. Yeah, exploring the poetry as a standalone series. Well, adding a sixth or seventh I lose track broadcast of the week might not be, in fact, the best method for this. I think that's probably not a good plan. So anyway, but I have, there are some other possibilities. So we'll see. we'll see. Not gonna close off possibilities there, but it's gonna need to be done. Indeed, I would love to have, I mean, a companion series to that. It doesn't have to be a companion book to that, but a companion series to that. Which is, you know, doing analysis and discussion of Tolkien's poetic corpus. You know, that's like bucket list material right there. So, yeah. Anyway, we'll see. Yeah, Carrie, I agree. We'll have to see. When the book comes out, perhaps there will be ways in which we can divide it up. If we do it maybe even in more than three divisions, and work our way through that after, because I mean, we are pretty close to finishing the history of Middle Earth. And so if we move on to that next and are still able to intersperse it with other books, that might work out. But anyway, yeah, so we'll see. Exactly. It'll be poem instead of home, Jackie, right? The poems of Middle Earth. Yeah, exactly. No, exactly, Matt. This is not me taking on new projects at all. I just want to make that perfectly clear. We'll figure it out. But it's pretty exciting. So, anyway, I just wanted to share the excitement. It's the big news of the day today. So, yeah, Johnny Scott's right. At Sunshine Moot, I did a talk. Well, it wasn't exactly a how-to, but I'm working on a thing. I'm now pretty convinced after my Sunshine Moot talk, I'm pretty convinced. It was part of my research, basically. It was experimental, my talk. I'm pretty convinced about this whole new level. I think that Tolkien is doing a thing in his poetry that I don't know any other 20th century poet who did. And I think it's pretty awesome. So, I'm going to put that together at some point, in the context of this too. We'll see. Who knows? Who knows where and how this is coming out. But, Anyway, sorry. We'll figure it out later. It's going to be awesome. Okay, Johnny, well, I'm not trying to tease it. What I'm looking at, because it's partially inspired by our discussions here, I'm looking at how he's deploying alliteration in his poetry. Because I believe that in his poetry, my hypothesis, for which I've been gathering more data, and I think the hypothesis is being borne out, that Tolkien was actually so he establishes a poem using normal poetic features like meter and rhyme. And then he overlays on top of that a far more sophisticated actual structure of alliteration on top of that, so that he's actually doing traditional English prosody in meter and rhyme, which is, it's essentially like a romance language. That's the romance language approach. You had I'm saying this from an English medieval perspective. You had the French poetry, which was in meter and rhyme, and then you had the English poetry, which was alliterative. Right. And he's basically, I think, especially in his mature poetry, that is the poetry that we see in The Lord of the Rings, he's doing them both at once. It's a kind of composite approach to poetic form that, again, I've never seen anybody else do that. It's really amazing. That was my hypothesis, and that's what I was looking at in my talk at Sunshine Moot. And I'm gonna keep kind of working that through and kind of exploring that a little bit more. And it would be neat to kind of get the chance to kind of look through his poetic corpus a little bit more fully there. But as I said, that theory of mine was inspired by, our discussions in which we've been, are the ways in which we've been looking at his use of alliteration in his prose. And then when I was discussing with Knew Better Do Better, Tolkien's poetry in conjunction with rap songs, thinking about hip hop prosody and Tolkien's prosody, that's when it really just kind of popped. And I was like, holy cow. Anyway, it'll be fun. So I'll keep working on that. We'll figure something out. All right. But let's jump back into today's text. Oops, I forgot to change the title. That's my fault. Sorry. Anyway, Gandalf is still, in fact, quick to anger. So I left the Boromir slide up here, even though we finished it, but we might get back to it. This is the slide we began last time, and now we're going to focus today on the last paragraph as we look at Gandalf talking about what he's going to do to open the door. And then we're going to go on and look at what he actually does to open the door. If you wish to know, I will tell you that these doors open outwards. From the inside, you may thrust them open with your hands. From the outside, nothing will move them save the spell of command. They cannot be forced inwards. What are you going to do then? Asked Pippin, undaunted by the wizard's bristling brows. Knock on the doors with your head, Peregrine Took, said Gandalf. But if that does not shatter them, and I am allowed a little peace from foolish questions, I will seek for the opening words. I once knew every spell in all the tongues of elves or men or orcs that was ever used for such a purpose. I can still remember 80 of them without searching in my mind. But only a few trials, I think, will be needed, and I shall not have to call on Gimli for words of the secret dwarf tongue that they teach to none. The opening words were elvish, like the writing on the arch. That seems certain. Okay. All right. So, first of all, quick note, because this just actually literally occurred to me while I was reading that first paragraph, and I've never thought this for the first time. And I've never thought this ever before. And that is, when Gandalf is explaining, I will tell you that these doors open outwards. From the inside, you may thrust them open with your hands. That is extremely counterintuitive. I feel like coming to Boromir's defense again here, right? On the one hand, Boromir's question was kind of rude, right? How could that be if you did not know how to enter? You told us you had once passed through the mines. How is that possible? We talked about this last week, and I think this is him just having no filter and being bewildered, not being necessarily aggressively rude against Gandalf, like actually making a premeditated accusation of dishonesty of Gandalf, but just him being bewildered and afraid and it coming out. But nevertheless, like the implication that Gandalf must be lying is there, right? And you can see that Gandalf gets angry at the implication. But to defend Boromir here, that's weird. A set of doors that is unopenable from one side, but able to just be pushed open, to be thrust open with your hand from the inside. Boromir would never have seen anything like that before, or likely have imagined anything like that before. That is to say, these gates work entirely by magic, right? That is absolutely abnormal. That is absolutely abnormal for gates. Now, Bob, I do acknowledge that it is probably up to safety code, since it's got to be easy to open doors from the inside so people can get out in case of an emergency, right? In case of Balrog, just push. It's fine. Right. But this is strange. And I think that there is a suggestion here. Boromir's bewilderment seems to me, well, I want to say wholly justifiable, because he is, yeah, Johnny, exactly. Things aren't adding up for him. If gates are locked, then they're locked. And if you can open them, then you can open them, right? I mean, like motion sensor doors that open when someone approaches them from the inside. Like, that's not a thing, right? He would... That you would... Having been through once, you would know how the doors open. Like, you could not have gotten through them if you didn't know how to unlock it. Again, it's natural to be thinking along those kinds of lines, right? So I think that the situation that Gandalf describes is, I think it's a little bit less intuitive than it might seem, especially once we as readers get used to this idea. Boromir, think about what Boromir is used to. Boromir is not going to be staggered by great and mighty constructions, right? He's used to that. I mean, he lives in a Numenorean city, for crying out loud, right? And there is in Gondor, especially in Minas Tirith and in other places, lots of evidence of the, like, you know, ancient lore and learning of the Numenoreans that has been lost to later ages and that no one can replicate anymore, which make things look like they, you know, were wrought out of the bones of the earth by the hands of giants, right? That's a normal experience for Boromir. So mere grandeur, even like specially awesome and effective architecture, like the walls of remember the walls of Minas Tirith are like the walls of Orthanc. The Ents would not be able to tear through the walls of Minas Tirith. And maybe it would take more than one shot from a trebuchet to just knock them over. Really small movie pet peeve there. I got so mad when they did all those shots of like the rocks hitting the wall and the wall just like crumbling, as if they didn't even have mortar. It was just like a Jenga stack or something getting knocked over. That was one of those things I remember sitting in the theaters being like feeling like wounded on behalf of the like Numenorean architects. But in any case, Boromir would be used to that kind of thing. So like a thing like the walls of Minas Tirith, which are like so great and so strong that it seems like magic to everybody. He's accustomed to that kind of thing. But the magic, right? The idea, this kind of idea of gates that open by themselves in response to a word from outside and just can be pushed open by one person with their hands from the inside without resistance, this is totally alien to his experience. And there's a kind, this is, I just don't want to pass over the fact that there is a wonder here, right? This is a wondrous thing. And it's another one of those things that is unlike anything that anybody does nowadays. Again, this doesn't make his questioning of Gandalf not at all rude. It is. But I do think his confusion, his bewilderment, is perfectly understandable. And that Gandalf's explanation is a bit surprising, right? Should be a bit surprising. I mean, this is an even more remarkable door than it seems. And by the way, as a little footnote, the theory that we have been kind of toying with, the idea that the doors are in some sense have something of a friendship detector worked in, as well as just responding to the word friend. You know, that there is some kind of active participation, right, on the part of the door, rather than merely being, you know, something that just turns on in response to those phonemes, right, pronounced in that order. Anyway, the idea that they can be pushed open with your hands from the inside almost, it seems to me almost to support that, right? That they are designed to recognize friendly, like if you're inside already and going out, it's how do doors know, right? I mean, before the age of motion detectors or anything like that, right? How do the doors know that you're pushing from the outside instead of pulling from the outside or pushing from the inside, right? Does it sense your hands on the inside and respond to that, right? How does it work? And yes, Bjorning, even the solid stone doors being pushed by hand suggest something, at the very least, remarkable engineering, right? Anyway, so it's it does suggest that there is something when we talk about, given that the doors are totally immovable from the outside and indeed even invisible from the outside, that means, remember, they can't be seen when shut. Like there's not even any cracks or joints in the door from outside. So I don't believe that it is merely remarkable engineering. Really, really well-crafted, counterbalanced, and engineered stone doors could potentially be pushed open by hand from the inside. Like, that is an engineering feat that is possible to achieve, I believe. But if the doors are sealed on the outside, like, I still think that the door itself has to in some way respond to the person pushing from the inside. I don't think it's just a matter of physical force, necessarily. Yeah, Cal Elros, that's exactly what I think. The lack of joints, the complete invisibility of the doors from the outside does imply that the stone itself is party to the opening and closing of the doors. Yeah, exactly. Matt, that's a really interesting point, too. He says, the more I think of it, the odder it is that these are called doors rather than gates. That shift in words, I suspect, adds a homeliness and a welcome instead of the sense of defense and fortification. I think that sense that we're thinking of these as a front door to a house is something Tolkien intended and was so successful that we didn't even notice it. Yes, yes. Right. yes. Lath-Lorna-Lath. Your name is rather hard to pronounce for me. I get tangled up in my liquids sometimes when I speak. Anyway, you're right that there is a certain similarity between these doors as I'm discussing them and the doors manufactured by the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation. yes, agreed. Anyway, my point is it does seem to me that there is some way in which the doors themselves have to respond. They're not merely passive in being pushed up. This is not just a set of stone swinging saloon doors that you're pushing open from the inside. So again, even that, I think, adds to the wonder of the doors rather than sort of, you know, simplifying it or detracting from it. Anyway, okay. Let's now go back to Gandalf's Gandalf's speech there at the end. I once knew every spell in all the tongues of elves or men or orcs that was ever used for such a purpose. I can still remember 10 score, that is 200 of them, without searching in my mind. Gandalf knows well in excess of 200 spells used in the tongues of elves or men or orcs for the purposes of the magic closing and or opening of doors. I have almost no idea what to do with that statement, to be perfectly honest with you. Right? So, for such a purpose, so, Kung Tater, this is an excellent first question. Could this be hyperbole? Yes. I think it could be. I don't believe he is citing a very precise number when he says 10 score. That does sound to me a little bit, at least, like an ambiguously large number. But I'm not worried about Gandalf's memory. I'm still stuck on there being 200 opening spells, period. I don't care what languages they're in. No, wait, I do. There are orc spells for this too. Orcs do spells. I guess. I mean, they do. Yes. Like, Gandalf says they do. So, there we are. In the Black Speech, Jackie, I assume? Probably. Do the orcs speak something other than the Black Speech? Is there a different orc tongue? I mean, we know that Sauron designed the Black Speech for the orcs to use. Is that a non-native? Do they have a separate native tongue? We do know that they have at least different dialects for Thalas, because they use common to talk to each other at times, as we know. Anyway, but let's not even get to the tongues of orcs yet. Let's just get to the word spell. Okay. I once knew every spell. So a spell is a word. It's like, what exactly does that mean? When he says every spell in all these tongues that was ever used for such a purpose, does that mean is this a list of passwords? My question is, wherein doth the magic lie? Is the magic in the word, or is the magic in the door? And I mean that about this door, but I also mean it in general. Like, is Gandalf saying that the making of magic doors that respond to words was so common that he knows off the top of his head 200 separate passwords that were used for this? If the magic is in the door, then it's just a password. And anyone, or again, maybe the door is sophisticated enough to recognize some and not others, but whatever. If the power is in the door, then it's just a password. It's not a magic spell being cast by the speaker. If the power is not in the door, but in the speaker, now we're talking about a spell in a different sense, right? I know it's hard. Several of you are wanting to talk about spell and counterspell as it's used later. Yes. Yeah, exactly. The door in the Chamber of Mazarbul is exactly the point that I'm talking about. We'll get there. And it won't be terribly long before we get there. All I will say is the use of the word spell tends to be... to use the word spell about something which is merely a password seems to me it would be an unusual usage of the word. The word spell is normally the combination of a verbal expression plus power, plus will, right? That you are asserting power through a thing that you say. That the words are the mechanism, the words of the spell that you utter is the mechanism by which some power is influenced. I'm thinking, for instance, of the prominent use of the word spell in the Beren and Luthien poem that Aragorn sings, right? Tenuviel, Beren calls to her, right? And a spell fell on Tenuvio. Exactly. Jackie was thinking of the same line. A spell fell on Tenuvio. She is afflicted. She is affected by the power of his words. Now, was Beren casting a spell? No, that's why it seems to be sort of metaphorically used in that instance. But that's the point, is that the metaphor, like by saying his words were as a spell, right, affected her like a spell would have affected them, tells us something about spells and what they are and how that works, right? Yes, a word or multiple words with power behind it. Yes. So I believe it seems to me fair to say we have seen Gandalf use spells on two occasions. When he lit the fire on Carathras and when he set fire to everything on the hill with the wolves, right? Both times, what Gandalf did seems to fit the requirements, right? He spoke words, and the words were the instruments of the exertion of his power. On Butterbeer's Burr, on Butterbeer's Beer, yes, presumably, and on Bill the Pony, right? Go with words of guiding, of guard and guiding on you, right? That seems to be a spell as well. Yes. Emily, the flash when Bilbo put the ring on at the party, I think that that's a spell too. It could just be fireworks, but I don't know that. I mean, it's possible Gandalf knew what Bilbo was planning to do, so he could have rigged something to blow up, right? I mean, he could potentially have arranged that, but of course, the fireworks themselves are also clearly that they are not, that Gandalf's fireworks are not arranged merely by, you know, pyrotechnic chemical engineering, I think is pretty clear, right? So when, therefore, Gandalf says, "I once knew every spell that was ever used for such a purpose," I have to believe that he doesn't mean, "I've known hundreds and hundreds of magical doors which had passwords, and I know the passwords to bunches of them," right? I don't think so. I think he's saying, there have been many spells used for opening things. And he seems to have made a special study of this. "I once knew every spell in all the tongues of elves or men or orcs." I mean, he sounds like Sherlock Holmes bragging about knowing the difference between different kinds of cigar ash, right? It sounds to me the tone there. I think that Gandalf has studied this sort of thing, right? He's like, again, it strikes me just like that moment in Sherlock Holmes, right? Where Sherlock Holmes says, "Oh, well, as it happens, I have made a special study of this thing, and I have, you know, I've written a small monograph on the subject," would be what Sherlock Holmes would say. When Gandalf says, "Actually, I've made a special study of opening spells," so therefore, this shouldn't be a problem. Corey says, so he's basically intending to hack the doors. Well, that's one of the things that we're going to look at, is that, in fact, Gandalf's approach. Okay, so Gandalf is telling us that he's made a special study of opening spells. He knows lots of them. And we have to accept this, right? There's no real room, I think, for skepticism. We can talk about Gandalf being hyperbolic. That's quite possible. Like, it may not be 200 of them exactly that he has in mind. He could be exaggerating there for effect. But whether he's exaggerating about the number or not, he clearly, you know, when Gandalf tells us that there have been many, many spells used by elves, men, and orcs in order to open things, I think that we have to believe it. Look where he goes on. "But only a few trials, I think, will be needed." Notice, this is why Gandalf was so confident, I think. Gandalf came through these gates from the other side. I think that he knows they can be opened from this side. He doesn't know what the word is. But he's not worried. This is also, remember, he is still responding to Boromir's challenge. Right? This paragraph is still an answer to the question, how could that be if you did not know how to enter? Right? What was the use of bringing us to this accursed spot? Gandalf is saying, let me explain why I wasn't worried, right? I am the king of opening spells, right? It's like one of my hobbies, okay? So I'm sure I can come up with an opening spell that will open these doors. And then he brags further, "Only a few trials, I think, will be needed." this is a pretty low security password. I'm pretty sure I can hack it. Right. And I shall not have to call on Gimli for words of the secret dwarf tongue that they teach to none. The opening words were elvish, like the writing on the arch. That seems certain. Right. So this is him, I think, beginning to sort of walk them through it aloud. The word's going to be in elvish, so that narrows it down a whole lot right there. Right. And I know a bunch of elvish opening words, so I'm going to use a bunch of opening words. As Anul'Bazar says, I bet one of those opening spells was blasting this door down the hall and out through the hill. Yes, exactly. That, of course, is the threat that he delivers to Frodo when Frodo won't open the door when he knocks on it at the end of chapter one. Remember when Frodo thinks it's Lobelia come back to, thinking of something really nasty and coming back to tell him. He opening spells. That's his thing, right? So that would be opening the door, an opening spell with great prejudice, right? Okay. So he's confident. He's confident that it's not going to take long to guess it, and he knows where to start. It's obviously going to be an elvish. So Bjorning, I think Bjorning was asking, he says at this point, I think Bjorning, you're talking about your like earlier reading experience, right? When you first read the book, you were disagreeing with Gandalf. You were like, why would it be an elvish? I like the idea of the password being in the secret language of dwarves, which they teach to none. We can already see Gandalf's reasoning. Gandalf says it seems certain that the opening words were elvish. Why? Because the password is designed for their elvish friends. That seems to be Gandalf's line of reasoning already. The fact that not only is the writing on the arch in elvish, it was written by an elf. Right, the signs of the collaboration from the two runes, right, the Narvi rune and the Celebrimbor rune up at the top, like it is explicitly an elvish dwarvish collaboration, right, and the symbols and everything else, right. So right, so. Bjorning, but at your first reading, you wanted, you were still wanting the secret language, right? Yes. I see. You think you wanted one of the signs of the collaboration between the Noldor and the Longbeards to be Celebrimbor knowing the secret dwarf language. It would be kind of cool if, like, modern people couldn't get it because none of the modern people know the secret dwarf language, but in the old days, they taught the secret dwarf language to Celebrimbor and all the other elves of Eregion, right? That, like, back in those days, the secret dwarf tongue wasn't secret because of their great friendship. That would be pretty cool. That would be pretty cool. But anyway, okay, so he seems to already be thinking in terms of this is a door, the outer side of this door is for the benefit of the elves. So the words are certainly going to be elvish. And then look at what he does. Look at what he does. He stepped up to the rock again and lightly touched with his staff the silver star in the middle beneath the sign of the anvil. Now stop for a second. He's wondering if there might be a tactile component. And the silver star. What's the silver star? What's the silver star? It's the Star of Feanor. Yes. Yes. Notice that that suggests that Gandalf is very much thinking that this is a, not just an elf-centered, but a Celebrimbor-centered spell, right? That the key to opening it may have some kind of somatic component, right? You might have to push in this spot, right? He does seem to be... So when he addresses himself to... Now, several, you're suggesting that it might be showmanship. Possibly. Possibly. But I think that that's... It shows that kind of this... Gandalf is thinking in terms of certain kinds of symbolism, right? And the symbolism that he is speaking of, he is kind of... By touching with his staff the Fëanorian star in the middle, he is... And so let's go for a second to... Yeah. So we'll get just back to the design here for a second. It's a good place to put it, but... I mean, it is kind of in the middle, right? But again, he knows there's no... he's not pushing. Like, he's not looking for physical leverage. The doors can't be forced inward. The doors come, they swing out, right? So he's not putting his staff there in order to push. So it's not, again, it's not physical leverage that he's looking for. It's this symbolic sort of appeal. Potentially, you could imagine, if the doors were designed in a certain way, if the doors were designed for elves to use, but still in a dwarf-centric way, you could imagine that, like, part of the opening ritual might be, like, I don't know what, like, reverently laying your hand on the hammer and anvil, right? The signs of Durin, right? And being like, oh, hey, Lord Durin, whose gates these are, you know, whose doors these are, like, I appeal to you, right? Please let me in. I'm your friend. Thank you very much, right? If they were Dwarocentric, Eric, exactly, as you correct me, they might be that. But that's not Gandalf's... That's not where Gandalf's head is, right? Gandalf is thinking 100% elf from the beginning, right? If there's going to be a symbolic kind of touching, if there's going to be a sort of a physical focal point of the opening spell, it's going to be on the Star of Fëanor, right? Okay, so... He lightly touches with his staff the silver star in the middle beneath the sign of the anvil. Anon Evelin, Edro Hiamen, Fenas Nagothrim, Lasto Bethlamen, he said in a commanding voice. The silver lines faded, but the blank gray stone did not stir. Many times he repeated these words in different order or varied them. Then he tried other spells, one after another, speaking now faster and louder, now soft and slow. Then he spoke many single words of elvish speech. Nothing happened. The cliff towered into the night. The countless stars were kindled. The wind blew cold, and the doors stood fast. Again, Gandalf approached the wall, and lifting up his arms, he spoke in tones of command and rising wrath. Edro! Edro! He cried, and struck the rock with his staff. Open! Open! He shouted, and followed it with the same command in every language that had ever been spoken in the west of Middle-earth. Then he threw his staff on the ground and sat down in silence. All right. Bjarning says, these doors will be locked due to too many unsuccessful attempts. Please try again in 1,000 years. Yes. Yes, exactly. So, big picture first. There's a bunch of things to notice, and we're not going to finish this whole slide tonight. We've been on a half of one slide and half of another slide kick for several weeks now. But look at the pattern. Look at the pattern of his approach. He begins with a verse. It's clearly a verse. You can hear it, right? Not only can you see the rhyme, but you can hear and feel it. The spell that he utters is poetic. Anon Evelin, Edro Hiamen, Fenas Nagothrim, Lasto Bethlamen. The parallelism of those lines, like the rhythmic parallelism, the different kind of sound connections between them, from the double ends in the first two syllable words at the beginning of the lines, Adnan and Fennas, which kind of mirror Amen and Lamen at the end. The three, so I mean, you got the Anon, Fenos, and then the three syllable word, Evelin, Nogothrim, which are interestingly parallel in other ways, but we'll get back to that. And then the three word phrase, two syllables, one syllable, two syllables, Edro, Hiamen, Lasto, Bethlamen. So it's, this is, this is ornate, right? This is a pretty fancy little couplet that Gandalf has made. How does it work? Now, what does it say? Don't look it up. And if you know, if you are an Elvish language scholar, don't tell us. If you don't know the languages, what does it say? What I'm wanting to get at here, remember, Tolkien loves providing us ways to learn the languages, right? Yeah, Erd, that's the exact... Look, we see how far he went of his way to give us one key, right? He translated the word open for us, right? Edro, Edro, open, open, he shouted. Okay. So we know what Edro means. So his first line has the word Edro in the middle. What else can we figure out? What else can we see? Lasto Bethlamen would be pretty hard. Edro Hiamen. Again, if we're just looking at it, when open, Edro, he seems to be speaking pretty clearly in the imperative there, right? So Edro certainly does seem to be spoken in the imperative. So Edro Hiamen. Hiamen sounds like a prepositional phrase. Nogothrim is another word that I yes, so I agree. Be honest, Honor, if we then hypothesize that the imperative ends with O, Lasto is probably also another, and especially given the clear and careful parallelism between the two lines, right? We can hypothesize that Lasto must also be an imperative, right? It doesn't mean open. We don't know exactly what it means. Yeah, Jackie, I think that the movie Arwen does use these words in at the, like when she's summoning the flood at the river, which is kind of funny. It works. It's just the, it's funny from the point of view of somebody hearing this. Like if you know the books well, but you don't know the languages, you'll recognize it as part of Gandalf's attempt to open the doors of Moria, and it makes it sound out of place, right? It's not necessarily, it works. Okay. So yeah, exactly. But I mean that, cause when I was sitting in the movie theater, I recognized it and I was like, is she trying to make the river open? Like, well, what exactly is going on there? Then I later on I figured it out, but still. She is. Because, of course, what Lasto Bethlamen means is listen to my voice. Basically, listen to my words. So yes, it is perfectly appropriate for movie Arwen to be asking the Bruinen to listen to her, right? Losto, yes, is here or something like that. Edro Hiaman is so Anon Evelyn Fenas Nagothrim. Nagothrim means the dwarfs. Nogrod, and again, we don't know that from, we're getting past what we can figure out from this passage in The Lord of the Rings. But if we read The Silmarillion, we can make a pretty good stab at that one. Nagothrim. So, as I recall, if I'm getting this correctly, Anon and Fenas are... Yeah, so Nagothrim means dwarves. Evelyn means elves. So once again, almost exactly parallel, right? Yes, Bjarnasana, you're exactly right. Hiaman is a prepositional phrase. I think Amen... I don't remember whether Amen is singular or plural. If that means open, like, to me or open for me, or whether it means, like, open for us. I'm not sure if it's singular or plural. Somebody who knows Sindarin better than I do will be able to tell us. Isn't Nagothrim one of the rude words for the dwarves? Naugrim, yeah, Naugrim is I think, the one that means the stunted people. Good. Yes, Bjarnasonar, that's excellent. On the door, we have Enin Durin. Enin Durin Aran Moria, which Gandalf translated as the doors of Durin, Lord of Moria. So Enin, we're told, is doors. And that looks a lot like Anon here. And makes you wonder, right? Is that similar? And yeah, I my understanding, and again, I may be translating this clumsily, we have the doors of the elves open to me, and I'm sorry, did you say is it plural? It's singular. Wait, Amen. Edro hi Amen is singular. It's plural. Okay, it's plural. Open for us. Open to us. Okay, it's plural. So, doors of the elves open to us, open for us. Right, sorry, Anon is singular, right? People are responding to different things. Anon is singular. Door of the elves open. So, Anon is singular. Enin, what's written on the door, right, is plural. So, Enin Durin means the doors, plural, of Durin. Just like Adan and Edain. Yes, exactly, Corey. We've already seen that one too, right? Dun Adan, man of the West, which Bilbo very carefully translates for us, right, back in Rivendell. Dun Adan. And we will have, I think we've gotten the word Dun Edain already and seen the plural of that. Amon and Emin, yes. Amon meaning mountain, singular. Emin meaning mountains, plural. Which we can see if we look at the maps very carefully, right? We might see the Emin mountain ranges, right, that have the word Emin in them. And we have already heard, I believe, the word Amon used, though again, we can see that on maps also. Yes. It's true that Krabain is the plural form of an inferred singular Kraban. Yeah, but I don't think we haven't gotten anything about that yet. But we certainly, right, we've gotten Amon Sul in the narrative. But again, the maps are fair game. They're at the beginning of the book, right? So we could definitely have studied those. So Anon, Doors of Durin. So the door of the elves opened to us. Fenas, hard for us to figure out what Fenas exactly is, but my understanding is it's like a variant, right? The door of the elves open now for us. The gates of the dwarves, Lasto Bethlamen. Hear my words. Hear my voice. Okay. So, yeah, is Fenas singular or plural? The gate of the dwarves? It's plural? Okay. I'm not sure. Anyway, whatever. The point is, Fen is in Fen Hollen is singular. Don't know. Never mind. Not going to worry about it. Point is, notice what is he saying? This is Gandalf's opening spell, right? Well, it's his opening spell. And what he does is what is Gandalf doing? Again, what's his approach here? I think it's pretty clear. Gandalf does not believe, that is, he does not come into this transaction believing that the utterance of a single word will cause the doors to open. When he steps up and takes his first crack at it, he composes a verse in Elvish, a carefully sculpted, balanced verse, which addresses the gates, addresses the door, and he's all ecumenical about this, right? He's like hedging his bets. Should I address them? The doors. I mean, should I address the doors as the door of the elves or the door of the dwarves? Oh, wait, I know. Both. And I think, yeah, it is 100% clear to me that this is impromptu, right? I know, Jackie, that Jackie was quoting the place in Parma, published in Parma, Eldorambaran, where Tolkien said that this was an impromptu composition by Gandalf. But you can tell that it is. That's my point, is I want to be looking at it sort of from within here. Just by looking at what he says, we can tell. This is tailored to this situation, right? Absolutely tailored to this situation. He has composed this little couplet, which addresses the doors as both the door of the elves and the door of the dwarves, right? There can't have been, like, this can't be a common opening phrase that was used all the time in the elder days, right? For different kinds of dwarves, because this was a unique situation. The friendship between Celebrimbor and, you know, between the elves of Celebrimbor, the elves of Eregion, and the dwarves of Moria. Not a common situation. So Gandalf is clearly has set a spell, which is customized to these doors in this situation. But I think it's clear. The very fact that he is composing poetry here suggests to me that Gandalf is not, trying to guess a password. He is instead trying to cast a spell. Does that seem a fair hypothesis? A fair... Oh, it's more than a hypothesis. That's a reading, right? That's my reading of this here. Yes, he's not trying to guess the password. He's trying to hack into the system, right? Though hacking into the system, it's not exactly... That's not quite the best metaphor, right? Hacking into the system, when you talk about hacking into the system, you're talking about, by your own ingenuity, circumventing the security procedures, right? That's not exactly what he's doing. Yeah, Eric, that seems to me more likely. He's using a power that he assumes is higher than the password. Yes, exactly. I won't need to know the exact password. I'm not going to sit here and just try to guess their password, right? Instead, I am just going to speak my own power, right? I'm going to address the gates with my own power and tell them to open to us. Bid them to listen to my words, right? Lasto, give ear, hear my speech. Open to us, hear my speech. I am Gandalf, right? Yeah, it's more like an admin password. Yes, exactly. I think this is a spell. I think there is power behind this. Notice that the approach here is very similar to his approach with the... He was giving imperative suggestions to the fire on the hilltop as well, right? He was telling the fire what to do, and the fire did it. He's here telling the gates what to do, and the gates, he's hoping, will do it, right? Again, I don't think this is he's not trying to dominate them. Like, he's not trying to blast them open. There's still a kind of appeal here. Again, he's reaching out to the gates. Hey, gates, right? Sup? Would you open for me, please? And when I say that, I'm going to exert my power. This is a spell, mind. I'm not just asking. This is a spell. My will and power is behind this. And I'm telling you to Lasto Bethlamen, to hear my voice. Right? Yes, I have power and authority. Respect them by opening. Yes. If I tell you to open, still comparatively nicely, right, will you open? And I think the touching of his staff to the Silver Star is connected with that. I think it's a kind of, like, appeal, right? Like, I'm starting with a kind of... It's a sort of a sign of respect. But he doesn't... He touches it with his staff, which is his own power, right? So he touches the staff of his own power to the Star of Feanor in the middle. So, hey, elvish magic, little wizard magic of my own here, right? Just to kind of establish this, right? You know, just so you know who I am, and you see that I acknowledge who you are, right? And your power. This is a little, you know, little peer-to-peer action here, right? That your sign of power will recognize my sign of power. Now I'm just going to say, exerting my power, hey, doors of the elves, open for us. Door of the dwarves, hear my voice. Now, Lupita, that is a marvelous point. If mere power could open them, Sauron would have. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I would think that Lupita Gandalf would say, he's not, again, that's why I don't think he's exactly hacking, nor do I think he's trying to, he's not trying to force it necessarily. I do think that he is, pulling rank isn't quite the right metaphor either, but it's a little closer to that, if you see what I mean. And notice he says it in a commanding voice, right? The silver lines fading do sound a little bit like a rejection. Doesn't that sound like a rejection? I think that's, no. Yeah, Josh, that's exactly why, that's the main reason why I don't think hacking is a good metaphor. Josh says that hacking is a violation, but this is not, he's not attempting he's not attempting to violate the dwarves. He's definitely not attempting to violate the dwarves. The doors he's not attempting to violate. It would be a violation of the dwarves to bust through their door. I do think, for Thoughtless, exactly that the lines fading is an indication that the dwarves are not happy with his attempt. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The lines are telling you how to get in. The lines are the welcome mat, right? Yes, Aranas, that I think is exactly it. That he's attempting, don't you know who I am, with the doors. Something like that. Yeah, more like that than like hacking, for sure. But again, not do you know who I am in the sense of like being offended or something like that, right? Or being arrogant. It's like one of the good guys here, right? Again, this is not Sauron marching up to the doors and saying, I'm going to blast you open. Now, next step, and I know we got to go soon, it's getting late, but next step. Many times he repeated these words in different order or varied them. So his first attempt is to speak this spell, asserting his own power, and he has shaped this spell very poetically, which I have to think, he thinks, makes it... I don't think this is just like his first of many attempts. I think that he, especially if this is extemporaneous, I think he thought about this. I think one of the reasons he's annoyed and wants everybody else to shut up is he wants to finish writing his poem, right? It's like, hang on. I gotta get the parallelism here. Like, this needs to be good. And then it didn't work. So what does he do? He tweaks it. He repeats these words in different order. Maybe it'll work better if I say, open to me, doors of the elves, instead of doors of the elves, open to me. Right? And yes, Eric, I exactly agree. Much like much Old English poetry, it was extemporaneous but composed of formulaic phrases or terms. Yes. Yes, exactly. So Gandalf's second move, his first move is this verse that he has composed. His second move is to revise the verse. He doesn't take a different approach. He still believes this approach is going to work. But there's something like he's not getting through to the door. For some reason, this door is just not lostoing, right? It's just the Losto Beth Lomond part not happening, right? So he's trying to find a different way. Is there a different way in which I need? Is there some other like formula of, I don't know what, politeness or whatever? Like, is there some other way that he can do this in order to make to get the doors to hear him? Right. Notice he varies even his delivery. Then he tried other spells. So after he does this, He tries other spells. And we're not told what those spells are, and therefore we can't exactly see how his strategy is changing. But of course, the mere fact that it says other spells confirms that what he did was a spell, not a password, right? He is still casting spells. He is still attempting to use his power to induce the gates to open, not necessarily force against their will, right? But to get through to the doors. And he tries those different deliveries. Faster and louder, soft and slow, right? Maybe it's about the attitude, right? In which you say these spells. Maybe that matters. Then he spoke many single words of elvish speech. So this is plan D now. Plan A was the first verse. Plan B is to modify that verse. Plan C is other verses, other spells. Plan D is single words in elvish speech. Now I think he's trying to guess passwords. Those single words are not spells. Right? And nothing happens. Like, is it a single command word? Is it a password? What exactly is it? He's saying a bunch of single words. By the way, I think it would have been really funny to be like Aragorn or Legolas listening to this and hearing all the different words that he's like throwing out there. But anyway, nothing's happening. Plan E. Again, Gandalf approached the wall, and lifting up his arms, he spoke in tones of command and rising wrath. Gandalf is now getting ticked off at the doors. "Edro, Edro," he cried, and struck the rock with his staff. "Open, open," and he beats on it. Plan E, I think, is not so much of a plan. Exactly, right? He's just angry. "Open, open," he shouted, and followed it with the same command in every language that had ever been spoken in the west of Middle-earth. I guess this is the extension of Plan E. Which, of course, is really kind of funny, right? Because, like, what are the odds? Could you imagine if it opened when he said the word open in some, like, really obscure dialect of, you know, like, of, like, the Druidon language or so, or whatever, you know, like, some totally random, like, it's perfectly clear that by the time Gandalf gets to Plan E, he has lost all confidence in being able to open these doors. His whole approach is failing. And now he's not just grasping at straws. He's now venting his feelings, right, against the doors. He is commanding them imperiously, angrily, in every language he can think of. And yes, Josh, yes, thanks, Bjorning. Josh is exactly correct. Not only did Gandalf not guess the riddle, he also missed the entire point. Absolutely. Absolutely. The fact that he is using opening spells and not passwords from the beginning suggests that, yes, Gandalf has missed the whole point. That's Gandalf's problem. And yes, Carrie, I agree with you that his struggle here is setting us up for his soon to come greater struggles. Yes, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I would also say that Aragorn's moment of foresight is sounding increasingly ironic. Remember what he said? "If you passed the doors of Moria, beware." I bet those words would sting a little bit if Gandalf remembered them at this particular moment, right? no worries there. Guess you're safe, Gandalf, right? anyway, we'll We'll come back to a couple things here in this slide at the beginning of next time, and then move on to the next one. But it's getting super late, and I'm going to let you guys go. Right, Gildalo says, if you don't pass the, you can't pass the doors of Moria, then what? Yeah, exactly. That's interesting. Eric says this feels a bit like what have I got in my pocket? Yeah, a little bit. An aggressively simple solution. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Tessa asks, why isn't anyone else trying? I think because they don't want Gandalf to knock on the doors with their head is why. I wouldn't say anything if I were watching this performance. Yeah, no way. No way. Yeah, sorry, Johannes. Yes, you did miss daylight savings time. It was this past weekend, so we are an hour different than European folks expect us to be. Sorry, but anyway, yeah, no, we should go on a new field trip tonight. We go, but I should be here next week as well. So we will finish the password sequence next week. We probably won't. Next week, we're going to get back to the pool and everybody being afraid of it. But thanks to everybody who, thanks folks who are here only for our book discussion here tonight. And, it's field trip time. All right. So
good evening.
Good evening. Tonight we're going to return to Moria.
That's going to be a frequent phrase.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just picturing, like, we see the other reason why Aragorn just kept his gob shut the entire time.
Yes. Yes.
People are like, why didn't Legolas say anything? I just picture him, like, opening his mouth about to say something, and then, like, Aragorn is waving his hands, catching his eye, and just going,
yeah, that's right. A little more hush here. Let the man think. Don't, yeah. Yep.
He's done thinking. Let him vent.
Yes.
But, we get back to the whole words or power thing because, you know, at some point he's just threatening to the doors. Look, words can make you. They can unmake you. All right. So we have a milestone to the Durin's Threshold.
We do. Yes. Milestone to Durin's Threshold.
Yep. I'm just going to fellow up everybody.
All right. Coming back in here.
Real quick. But, the bit where he's pleading with the doors, it reminds me a lot of fairy tales, like Finnish, Russian, Polish fairy tales, where you often have the hero or heroine beseeching inanimate objects to do things for them. Oh, dear rosy-fingered dawn, beautiful red sun, please don't rise so I can finish knitting my sister's stocking. You know, that sort of thing. And it's like we get into that point where we're beseeching the object as if it has a life of its own.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, at any point did he try flattery with the door? Or is that just a... You think that would be beneath him?
We don't know. I plan C, where he's doing other spells, like perhaps... Or even in the adjustment in plan B, when he adjusts the words that he's using, maybe he... maybe it's one of the changes he's making, right?
Tolkien got this mad trying to word a poem exactly right, too.
Right, exactly. So yeah, maybe his approach is different there.
No, too much internal rhyming on this one. It's screwing up the meter. Do it. Too much assonance, not enough alliteration.
Yep. I think I didn't get in the raid yet, so.
I'll meet you there then, I guess.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I just got here, back to the threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
where are you?
Standing in the middle of the floor, and I'm looking up at the ceiling, and I'm thinking these buntings across the ceiling surely are of recent date, right?
Unless they're made out of rock, then yeah.
You'd think, right? In which case, kudos to whoever climbed up and tied the ones that are hanging from the natural ceiling of the cave.
Wow.
Because that's dedication to concept there.
It looks like there's a walkway up there.
Oh, yeah. No, not the ones that are suspended from the walls. The ones that are actually hanging from straight down from the ceiling.
Straight down from
the middle of the roof.
Middle of... I can see this. I can see things. Oh, yes, quite. What'd they do? Just fire an arrow up there?
I don't know. It's pretty intense.
These truly are magical and secretive peoples.
Yeah, and JJ, that is interesting to remember. We're told about how fancily carved, fancily and indeed fancifully carved, like the halls of Menegroth are, or even the halls of the Elven King in Mirkwood, you know, with the pillars looking like trees and the fact that they left the natural roof here is I think interesting. And it's one of the things that I want to be looking at as we go through what is in different places around Moria. What does Lotro suggest about the relationship between the dwarves and the stone, like between the dwarves and the caverns? As presumably there are some natural caverns here. It's not all of it necessarily just carved out of hard rock, as Sam was saying.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, they...
Oh.
Yeah, so how... This is one place where we can see... I doubt that this was simply like laziness, that they just like, we can't be bothered to carve the ceiling. That seems to be... Now, this is the back door, right? So this is... And this is the mud room of the back door. So this is huge and grandiose, but it's still not the main entrance to Moria here. And yeah, JJ, I was noticing that too, that the hanged banner isn't hanging from the ceiling itself. It's hanging from a worked pillar that is carved in. So that does suggest that they put that pillar in the ceiling. I think the old dwarves did. So I think they attached the banner to a like banner hook that they found there in the ceiling. It's doubtless what gave them the idea.
Maybe a pulley system.
Something. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm just interested in the explorers talking amongst themselves, because it really gives you a little glimpse into this this expedition after the failure of the first one.
Balin's expedition, yes.
Yeah, Balin's expedition, yeah. Because we're getting a lot of dissent in the ranks here. They miss their beer, they miss the supplies, they miss their families.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of them's, you know, droning on about glory, full glory. Yeah, you try by guiding a beast through these windy passages.
Yes.
That's literally what the answer from one of the explorers is.
Right, right.
So.
Yep.
Yeah, this guy just keeps wanting to go on about glory and how much they need our help, and everyone else is just griping and grousing.
Yeah, it is interesting. Well, let's head up the stairs.
Oh, Mazog, I hate that guy.
The Dolvin View and the Deep Descent. Thanks
both
for the
these
directions. Okay,
yeah,
so
finally.
These crystals, and of course these crystals are designed to sort of look like or imitate flames, right? It looks like, you know, a large brazier that you would expect fire to be coming out of to light things up.
It's like if you froze fire.
Yes. Yeah. Frozen fire. So it is a really, interesting effect. Okay. So now right here at the top of the stairs, we're at this four-way intersection.
The cobwebs everywhere are discerning, because we know what leaves big cobwebs like that.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we can already guess what we might see. All right. So right up here. Yeah, well, so On the one hand, yes, we can use goats. I'm going to use my Elder Slayed boar when we need it. But I don't know how much we're going to use the goats here right
now. It'll mostly be from place to place.
Exactly, because I'm going to keep exploring station by station here. So, yeah. All right, so we come to the top, and we see three things. Down each side hallway, we see very prominently these dwarf statues at the end of the hallway, right? So we see this large archway. So there's a sort of a wall built down. I think this really strongly suggests to me that this whole thing was a natural cavern. This part of it, anyway, was a natural cavern. They've built this wall to, like, partition the cavern. If they only wanted an opening this high, and I say only this high, it's already like 25 feet high, right? But
yeah.
But even if all they wanted were this 25-foot archway here, if they're carving this out of rock, they're not going to carve the other 25 feet out just to build a wall here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's clearly a natural cavern, which then they felt they needed to build this wall in order to partition and create this somewhat smaller corridor, but still significantly high corridor with these chandelier crystals. No more. So we've got the three different forms of the lighting crystals. We've got the brazier crystals, the ones that look like the flames. We've got up here the torch sconce crystals. Mm-hmm. So sort of more fake flame, but instead of just looking like flames, it's like the whole torch. So you just got the crystals themselves in sconces. And then we've got the chandelier crystals now, the big spiky.
There's a fourth type at the top of the steps there.
Yeah, which is kind of like a variant of the brazier crystal, isn't it? Because it still kind of looks like it's in a brazier. It just doesn't look like fire. It's a solid, it's a solid thing.
I guess. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and there were a couple of the chandeliers down at the bottom. Sorry, I'm looking at the banners. Wow, those banner poles do hang down. The banner pillars from the ceiling come down quite a ways.
Oh, we got a chandelier that fell onto the ground over here.
Down or up?
At the top of the steps on this side over here on the...
Yeah, right, yeah.
We can see it doesn't light up when it falls down.
Ah, yes. So when the crystal shatters, the light goes out. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Means whatever enchantment or mechanism in there.
It does suggest that it is a mechanism, because if it were just if it were just in the nature of this crystal to glow, it would glow in whatever pieces it were in.
A flammifer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've not imperishable indefinitely, but we don't know if there's a shelf life if left intact.
Right. Well, probably, but there can't be much of a shelf life. I mean, there's no way that these new dwarves of this expedition, that they went out of their way to hang buntings from the ceiling in the opening hall, it's a little bit much for them to do, but it's still like, that's their starting point, right? They were celebrating entering Moria again, so I can buy that. But there's no way they hung all these crystals. So
no, I meant like, did they activate the crystals when they came back, or are the crystals still working with whatever enchantment was made on them?
Yeah.
Ages ago, or Balin's expedition, or the Second Age, or before, we don't know.
Yep, we don't know.
We don't know, how long they last if undisturbed.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't know. So, hang on, that other hallway, we can't go down past that rockfall, right?
I don't remember. We can try.
So. Down this way, I don't think we get much. Is this a dead end? Nope.
Steps. Oh, this is the walkway we saw where the bunting...
This goes up to
the... lower buntings are hung here. During threshold in the north wing.
Okay, so this goes up to the service
Oh, another broken one.
Service overlook here. Yeah, okay, so we're up by the stairs. So if you go along this ledge, makes it easier to hang bunting, that's for sure.
Yeah, I wonder if there was like a two-part pulley system, like one person stands here and the other person stands here to get the one that's in the middle.
Yeah. Still long ways, but...
Well, maybe it lowers down on a chain and then you wind it up again.
Maybe.
Well, there's some sort of rope just hanging. Is that a bunting or is that just a rope? No, that's bunting.
Yeah, it's one of the hanging buntings, I think.
It looked like somebody had started hanging something and gave up. Oh, yeah, no, there's something up here, too. What is that? A big dangly thing. What are those?
A dangly thing that's up here on the...
It's dangling from the ceiling from something that looks like a big arm or whatever. I can't tell what it is from here. Oh, it's holding the lamps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The dwarf statue is holding the lamps. Yeah.
It's a big fist holding the lamps up here.
Yes.
No, the ones up here. It's just an arm. It's right. Just a big old arm.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Totally disembodied arm.
Yeah. This must have been where another lamp was before it fell and crashed.
Whoa.
Because all the other ones have lamps on them.
That's weird.
Yeah, it looks like they can be raised and lowered.
Is there a crank somewhere that tilts, that brings the arm down or something?
No, it just looks like there's some kind of... It's hard to tell in this lighting, I gotta say. I wish, for all the lamp holding, it could do a little better. I think there's a seam running down the middle that makes it look like it could go up and down, but that just could be where the chain or whatever is anchored.
Yeah, they're both. They're all disembodied arms. Weren't the statues along the wall down there holding out lamps too?
Yeah, I think so. I thought they were just holding axes. Ooh,
the
big
ones
furnace.
Up by the where the milestone were.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, there were full. I think it's below us.
Yeah. This is the biggest lamp we've seen right here near this furnace. This is a big old lamp.
Because, so, from where I am, looking down across the bottom, that statue that, as I recall, the mirror reflection of that one on the side below where we are right now mm-hmm. has a hand out holding out the lamp.
Yeah.
But then up here, instead of having full dwarf statues, they just have the arms.
Recycling?
That is so strange. But you
maybe
know
it's supposed to be like the many forces, the like an army or something.
You know what I can't help but think is that this is designed to look cool from below.
Yeah.
That like
absolutely.
It's, maybe from below you can see. Now I want to go back down and see what we see.
Well, if I could see, we could barely see the walkway down there. All we could see were the little corners of the lamps.
Yeah.
That's why it took me so long to figure out the bunting.
Right.
So, like, who are they? Are these supposed to be brighter?
Well, it's true that, well, I wonder. It's actually a good question. Are these crystals dim, like, with age? Are they fading? You know, did they used to be brighter in their heyday?
Or is the magic dying or something like that?
Or do dwarves need less light and we just think it's not bright because we're not dwarves?
I'm an elf, excuse me.
I know, but, you know, still.
Yeah, no, it's a good question.
Yeah.
This is pretty bright. Like this.
Yeah, this one in here is much brighter. And look at the ceiling in here. This is a finished room all the way around.
Wow.
That's a gorgeous ceiling.
How did the copper keep its color?
And it's a beautiful... it's a beautiful pattern, which, because the individual, like, so you've got all these, like, pentagons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the pentagons themselves are irregular. That is, they're not equilateral. There are some equilateral pentagrams in there.
Yeah, they looped. It's more of a knotwork where it's a continuous line that loops.
And yet, so, like, my first impression was of asymmetry, right?
Uh-huh.
But then... you look at it and you're like, no, actually, it is symmetrical. It's perfectly symmetrical in the bigger picture, right?
I get the feeling we're going to have that revelation quite a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, so it makes it a more complex design. And then, of course, when you look, the detail within those copper bands is more irregular shapes and, like, pentagrams and things, which also, I bet you, has a larger pattern as well.
With these beautiful, like, eight-sided mandalas here.
Yeah. Yeah, and those were the...
Notice there's no notice there's no spider webs anywhere here. They cleaned this place.
Yeah, they cleaned this one out. The new dwarves cleaned this one out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so here on the side, we got the same stuff. This is the same as the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as I recall, here it is on this side. That eight-sided mandala thing is the same that we have here. And notice what we have. The interlocking rings design, which is the same as we saw on the bridges crossing the river into the Vales of Anduin.
Oh, yeah.
But those were Moria bridges, so that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I don't remember seeing this this eight-sided star thing elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a new one on me. I'd be curious to see where else we end up seeing it.
Yeah, and the combination of the eight-pointed star within and then the eight-sided... So the eight-sided star is the overall shape, and then you see the eight-sided star is the inner shape also, though angled differently, right? Turned sideways. And then you've got another eight-pointed star formed around that. And then you've got the pentagons, again, the irregular pentagons forming the loop around. It's a really cool design. All different kind of geometrical designs that are not even necessarily, but they form this, like, beautifully symmetrical image.
I didn't think you could combine Celtic with Art Deco, and they've masterfully done it.
Yeah, no, it's very cool. It's very cool. So yeah, it's fun to see these a little bit closer up, and we can see these at the heart of that larger design in the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can see this disco room over here. Like, this is the morale room. This is where everyone's going to feel like the Moria can be taken again.
Right. This is the party room. So.
Well, but there's a guy giving a speech right there. He's giving a motivational speech while they're all working on stuff. As opposed to the guy standing next to the overturned cart, I think this guy's going to make a better impression.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But now I'm thinking, okay, so we've got a big dwarf forge.
Yeah, the hammer's ring. Yeah, like this is like, that's got to be a big morale booster to have the forges lit and the ringing of hammers and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like your gonagals.
Yes. But I'm thinking here not just of... I mean, it makes sense that they would come to this right away. That they would come in here and they would be like, hey, look, there's a workable forge right inside the door. How convenient. Mm-hmm. This is our base of operation. Of course, we see them. They're repairing tools and such.
Yeah, that one's got a pickaxe. This one has an axe.
Yeah. So all of that, it makes sense from a practical standpoint there. But I want to talk about the original purpose of this room.
Mm.
It's getting late. But anyway, I want to talk about the original purpose of this room. And because this is the back door,
mm-hmm.
right? And I was about to call it an antechamber to the back door, but this is not an antechamber. It's mm-hmm. not convenient I mean, it's just around the corner from the back door. It's closer to the back door than many things. But it's not like it's an antechamber to the back door. You have to go all the way out around and down the stairs to get to the back door from here. This is adjacent to the back door. It could be a guard overlook, though, again, you can't do anything about that space down here. I mean, I guess you could shoot, theoretically. But it doesn't seem like a defense.
You could just drop things on them.
Yeah, though the middle of the floor is a pretty long way to drop, to throw or drop something from here. Anyway.
If there's a release for the forge.
Yeah, I think this is... And we remember this was a one-way thing. We came up the stairs, and you could go either way. And then it was just... But they were just a one-way. It wasn't just like a whole network of streets or something.
Yeah, we bypassed the main passage.
Yeah, the main passageway is the one that went straight, presumably. But these passages to the side just curled around to these upper galleries up here. And so these upper galleries, that it has a forge here... You know, no multiple forges. How many forges? Three forges. So three separate forge rooms here. And I'm really struck by... struck by several things here. I'm really struck by how fancy this, like with the ceilings and everything.
Yeah.
How they put that copper inlay on the ceiling here like they did not do in the main entry hall. And I certainly don't think that the distance, the height of the ceiling was dismaying them. You know, was preventing them from doing it.
Oh, all right. No.
Well, let's think more about this.
Yeah, let's ruminate.
Let's ruminate about this and we'll see. We'll come back to this. There's several other features of these rooms that are fun to think about. So let's think a little bit more about these wings and try to see if we can come to a better understanding of what this... Because again, what I'm thinking of here, throughout Moria, I want to be thinking about what does this tell us about the culture of Khazad Dûm, right?
Yeah.
Because the fun thing about doing these kinds of investigations is doing an analysis of Lotro's adaptation of the text through their visuals, right? Through how they've designed these areas. Because they're not just putting stuff up here, right?
Yeah.
These things are designed to be... This is an adaptation. This is an interpretation that they're providing to us here. So that's what we're going to continue looking at. So we'll see. Let's think about some ideas and theories about what these rooms tell us.
Sure.
About
Dwarf. Someone take a note. There is a pool with a decorated bottom and steps over there to our left.
Okay. So we'll come back here next time.
Because I want to talk about that. I have theories.
I see how there's a party in the pool going on already over here. Okay.
Yeah, but the bottom is gorgeous. Like, if you step in the water, you can see the decoration on the bottom. So, for next time.
All right. We'll check out the pool next time. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Lots more to think about here. So we'll think about this whole entrance complex, threshold complex, and see if we can draw some conclusions about this, and then maybe we'll move on down the hall. And that's where you can see why I don't know how much demand there's going to be for goats, because we're going to be moving relatively slowly. But we will need to make up time the further we get away from the door, and the further we get away from a milestone. But... All right. Pool party next week. Thanks, everybody. See you guys next week. Bye now.
See you then. Bye.